I'm going to do a reading from the Insight Journal. It was put out by a BCBS from the winter of 2009. And it's another talk of Ajahn Suchito called Working with Perception. What is perception? It's the most immediate derived sense of an object. It's a flower. It's a car. It's a person. There's a mild impact, contact, a sense of, ah, something strikes the eye. There's an immediate flurrying or movement around what that is. This becomes more apparent when you meditate and slow the mind down so that you find some space between the rush of ideas and moods. Then, as you're abiding in a fairly spacious state, you feel how things strike you. It could be pleasant, like a bouncing chipmunk running across the path in front of you. There was stillness, then you get the touch of contact, maybe a brief mental movement of alarm. Then, oh, it's a little chipmunk. There's contact, then perception, sanya, the moment of recognition. Then a conceptual label that tells you what it is. Though really, this is what the thing means to you. Varieties of perception. Perceptions are meanings, so they are subjective and depend upon, first of all, functioning sense faculties which are limited and conditioned. They can't give us truth. They can only give us pieces that work for us. For example, what's the world like to a bat? Humans mostly operate through visual and mental activity. Bats don't do visuals. They squeak thousands of times a second, so they create this huge sound net reaching out. Flittering around at night, they don't hit things. They form perceptions based on sound, and through that they can detect and catch all kinds of bugs. What's New York like to a dog? I bet skyscrapers don't mean anything to dogs, but who peed on that fire hydrant is probably headline news. Dogs check out the scents of who or what passed through an hour or more ago. They're able to track this to a fine degree. So the first level of subjectivity of it all depends is one of the sense system of each specific being. What is color to a colorblind person? In some cases, people suffer from neurological damage. Some people can't perceive movement because the nerve endings in the little bit of the brain that register and understand movement have been damaged. So, for example, they can't track and interpret the range of visual change that tells most of us that a car is coming towards them. First, it's a small car, then a slightly bigger car, another bigger car, a fender, and then blackness. The brain can't get a sense of the synchronized movement coming out of that. Another example is synesthesia, a mix-up of senses where people associate one sense with another. They might see music or associate a number with a color. Number 5 is blue, or Tuesdays are green. They don't know why, that's just what comes up. Most of us, to some degree, are synesthetic. That's what onomatopoeia is about. Certain sounds give you an impression of something. Say you have a kind of very soft, spongy, amoeboid object on the one hand, and you have something that's made out of shards of broken glass on the other. A Martian comes down and says, "This one's a bobble wobble." Which one do you think he's talking about? You'll say it's the amoebic thing because we associate that kind of sound with that particular form. If the Martian said, "This is a ki-ki, ki-ki," you'd think of the broken glass as being sharp, narrow sounds. Sounds transfer into visual memories and metaphors. Some perceptions depend on karmic meaning, on one's own history, even sometimes from uterine experiences. If your mother is in a state of anxiety or depression when you're in the womb, all those neurohormones are going to affect your neurology. So you can have an unsafe feeling with regard to what you're in that has no specific object. It's because of what you've been doused in. In this case, it might set your neurological barometer to what's around me is not comfortable. Some people get extremely afflicted with mental perceptions. Say you're claustrophobic. You always feel oppressed by being in something. Or agoraphobic. You feel frightened if you come out of something. You can't be rationally convinced because it can't be rationally processed. It's perceptual. Reflex perceptions. Dependent upon mental perceptions or felt meanings, our reflex actions and programs come up. The sankharas, dispositions, programs, or activities, start operating dependent upon these meanings. So, for example, we come to a meditation retreat with a sense, I chose to come on retreat, I wanted to come on retreat, I really needed to come on retreat. Then we sit down and the perception arises of lonely or lost or estrangement and, I don't want to be here with this. What happened? We maybe feel controlled by the structure or we don't feel safe with so many strange people. All that reflexive stuff kicks in because often when we meditate, we come underneath the surface to the felt meanings of things that have defined me at a very basic level. And then reflexes start kicking in. I remember when one of the nuns went on a long-distance walk out in the moors. She had to walk 10, 12 miles in the rain, in the cold, and carry her bulky bag and tent, and live pretty rough. But it felt blissful because she was choosing to do it. Whereas to walk up the hill from the nun's cottage, 300 yards from the main house every day, just felt like a real pain and unfair, because it's something she had to do. That feeling of oppression touched a reflex. The Honeyball Sutta, Madhupindika Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 18, has a beautiful description. Dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. Eye consciousness arises from a sense base, an object. The meeting of the three is contact. So, bong, something strikes. With contact as a requisite condition, there is feeling. What one feels, one perceives. What one perceives, one thinks about. What one thinks about, one complicates. Based on what a person complicates, the perceptions and categories of complication assail him or her as regards the past, present, or future forms cognizable via the eye. So there's a process whereby something starts off as involuntary. We've got an eye and the form arises, and bang, eye consciousness happens. There's no action in that. Something just occurs. The meeting of the three is contact. So again, that's completely passive. With contact, there is a requisite condition. There is feeling. Suddenly, a subject has crept in there. Before, it was all impersonal. Now it's become one feels. It's not sketched in at this moment as him or her. It's just one. When feeling arises, the first thing that happens is, ah, I am feeling. But it's an impersonal sense of self. I'm feeling this. This is happening to me. So the perception rises up and labels the feeling, and with it arises the sense of one who feels. Then what one perceives, one thinks about. Now a little more action starts occurring, thinking. This is much more to do with personal history. Adding the narrative of, I'm always with this, I'm the victim, he is, she never does, etc. So what one thinks about, one complicates. There is this word, complicate, or papancha, which also translates as proliferates, or projects, or diversifies. Suddenly it becomes all kinds of manifestations. It's this, it's that, it shouldn't be, could be, ought to be, reminds me of this, what am I going to do about that? Sound familiar? I call it the papancha fairy. She waves a wand and then suddenly all this stuff comes rising up. You can drop one or two words like current president and bong, all this stuff comes rising up. Cascades of emotionally charged thought, perceptions of he, she, it, he can't and shouldn't and how dare they, and so on. You feel drenched in gobs of past, present, and future. That's the flooding based on what perception brings up. Somebody gave an example of twilight. You see this object on the path, and the first thing is a shock. It's a snake, and then, all right, it's a rope. The first perception isn't necessarily accurate, but there's an emotional tone. It could be fear, joy, desire, aversion. Something wants to retract, or something wants to go out and meet it. You notice it when it's unexpected. You walk around a corner, and there's somebody standing there you weren't expecting, and there's an immediate shock. It's somebody in a uniform. Oh, dear. Whereas if it was a small person in a jumpsuit, you wouldn't feel the same way. It's not just a visual object that's arisen, but a meaning has arisen. That's the perception. So from an immediate external sense, sight, sound, or touch, comes a recognition that something is impacted. That's contact. And there's a naming. With naming, feeling and perception arrive and trigger off an act of conceiving. That name may not stay for very long. You may, in fact, go back to that visual object in a split second and check it out. Oh, it's not Jack, it's Fred. Oh, he's not angry, he's just got a headache. Those perceptions shift, but they all refer to mood tones, which can be fundamental things such as safety, pleasure or pain, control or freedom. Some of these perceptual meanings get built up through history. If it's your house and you see things and there's a feeling, oh, I should do this because the carpet's untidy, or the paint's coming off the wall, or something like that, I should do it. Somebody else's house, you think, oh, look at that. You don't get the same feeling. You might think, why don't they do something about it? The sense of self also comes in with naming things as this is mine or not mine. These are the kind of root meanings that get established, and they don't necessarily start running as thoughts. They're just emotional positions. As we first perceive an object, green, red, black, white, car, dog, whatever it is, that's the first way in which it's named. Then it's referred to the mind, which adds its own meanings. So you get this interplay between different levels of perception. The concept arises, it's to be protected, it's to be cherished, or whatever it is. It wouldn't be the case if it was a different concept, such as it's somebody else's or it's a wreck. The mind also has its own sense base, which is concepts, which also generate the same kind of meanings, essentially safe, warm, comfortable, mine, not mine. Perception and truth. Interestingly enough, in Buddha Dharma, the aim is not really to find truth per se. All truth is considered to be contingent, relative. The main thing is not ultimate truth, but peace, realization. Truths are of a relative nature, the relative truths of suffering and cessation of suffering, which are contingent upon the experience of suffering and not suffering. They don't exist in abstract. They're not ultimate truths, whereas the Western mind often believes there is such a thing as ultimate truths. In any action, the important thing is the perceptual meaning, because that tells you something about where your own angle is. So you walk through the kitchen here, and your sleeve catches a cup and knocks it onto the floor and smashes the cup. You might get the feeling, oh, goodness me, I've done something wrong. Or it might be, what idiot put that cup there right in the way? So which is the truth? Or you could get philosophical about it and say the cup is of a nature to break. It's just fulfilling its purpose. Or you could be Zen. There's no cup, no breaking. Everything is just in a neither broken nor unbroken state. Or, it's my karma to break a cup. It had to happen because of something I did in a previous life. Or, if you're a politician, you can say, we managed to go through the kitchen with no damage at all to teapots and saucers. It was successful. There was a little collateral, but we don't think it's in the public interest to let you know about that. And you could say that's true also. When you touch into the meanings of what actually happens, they're not concepts that float around as abstract realities of an undying nature. They're actually momentary and subjective and intimate experiences that keep rising up. They're not true in an ultimate sense, but they're actual. All we want to know about is not what's ultimately true, but how do we release ourselves from suffering and stress? The problem of truth is that concepts and ideas are abstract. By themselves, they have no explicit felt meaning until they're introduced to each individual's mind. So, if you were in the Second World War, the words Germany or Japan would have triggered off different meanings in the minds of people who were on the other side of that conflict. Nowadays, it would trigger off different sets of meanings. In terms of music, Germany means Bach, Beethoven, and so forth. If you thought of it in terms of the Second World War, you thought of Hitler and Nazis. Through examining and contemplating perceptions, we begin to see the relative truths of the angles or biases that we have, the blaming, self-blaming, or justifying, or ignoring. So if you knock a cup over, that touches the thing of wrong, done wrong, and then you get this whole flurry of, I hope I don't get found out, or, what an idiot I am, or, I'm always doing this kind of thing, or, why can't I be more mindful? All of which have some truth in them, a truth about who we are, or the kind of karma that's running. Perceptions don't give you an ultimate reality. They give you a subjective readout of where you're coming from. We begin to see obsessions and latent tendencies that flare up. The more you contemplate this, the more you get a profile of the kind of tendencies that cause one's suffering. Stress, imbalance, agitation, defensiveness, anger, greed, and so forth. Widening the field. Perceptions are what you have to bring your Dharma practice to bear on, along with the reflex dispositions and programs of self. So there may be the tendency to find fault with yourself or with others, or justify yourself, or to basically space out and forget the whole thing altogether. It's also the case that practice entails deliberately inducing perceptions through concepts. Meditation itself starts with establishing skill for perception through selective thinking, otherwise known as wise reflection. The first reflection is of refuge. We check in with the reality of being here and how we can be with that. This means taking refuge, and we do that by establishing the felt meaning, the perception of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, that which is compassionate, clear, and wise, the way and the teachings, the exemplars. We bring these into our lives by bringing them into our minds. And along with those reflections comes a sense of belonging to something good and wise and trustworthy, shared by many people throughout time and place. Another reflection brings up the perception of impermanence. You acknowledge that this changes and that changes, and bringing that into practice is more than an idea. We experience through direct perception that sensations change and feelings come and go. So the reflex reaction to feelings gets checked. This is not really making a comment on the nature of what passes, whether you're glad it passed. It just helps to shift your way of perceiving to a wider frame of reference, not focusing so much on the topic itself, but upon its changing nature. This lightens a lot of the conceptual intensities that can occur around topics such as a thought sensed as a feeling. Where a thought comes up, we may think, terrible thought, hideous thought, ugly thought, shouldn't have this thought, wow, where did I ever get this thought from? Or we can notice that it is a changing energy. You can widen the perceptual field in terms of time, just holding that space of perception for a few moments in which the thought comes, flies around, and fades out. Then there's a different emotional sense that comes with that. Detachment and dispassion arises, which is calming and steadying and supports clarity of response. This is what people often call vipassana, developing non-attachment through experiencing change. This perception allows you to address a very wide field of phenomena, one which includes the liked and the disliked, the urgent, the unimportant, the trivial, the nonsensical, the confused, which fall into that same pattern. Whereas if one wanted to focus purely on the liked, then some objects wouldn't fit into that category. So you grow broader and your confidence in being at peace with the unwelcome and the weird develops accordingly. Widening the perceptual field also means we include what it is that self and other have in common, such as that we all dislike pain, we all appreciate pleasure, we all want safety, we all like friendliness, simple things. We widen to the we sense. This helps to generate sensitivity to ethics and compassion. Generally speaking, the wider the perceptual field, the more skillful, because the more things you can fit into that, the less conflict, division, and bias there is. This widening also helps us recognize what we leave out, parts of ourselves perhaps that we don't really like to attend to, the grubbier or the less pleasing aspects of the body, or our death or sickness. But with detachments, it's just a body and it changes, and all bodies do this. We can widen and be with that, and the mind becomes more peaceful, less defensive, and less obsessive in those respects. Non-conflict. The Honeyball Sutta makes a related point about views. Dandapani, stick in hand, out roaming and rambling around for exercise, went to the great wood, went to the Blessed One, who was under the bilva sapling, exchanged courteous greetings with him, and stood to one side. As he was standing there, he said to the Blessed One, "What's the contemplative's doctrine? What does he proclaim? In other words, what's your statement about ultimate reality?" And the Buddha says, "Well, my statement is that any kind of doctrine, the sort of doctrine where one does not keep quarreling with anyone in the cosmos, that sort of doctrine where perceptions no longer obsess the Brahman who remains dissociated from sensual pleasures, such is my doctrine." So he doesn't give him a concept of what it is. He just says, basically, it's anything that fits within his sense of non-quarreling, non-conflict, non-obsession. So Dandapani shakes his head, wags his tongue, which is an interesting gesture, wagging the tongue, raises his eyebrows so his forehead was wrinkled in three furrows, and left, leaning on his stick. In other words, it went over his head. He was looking for some concept that he could quarrel with, and the Buddha didn't give him anything. You also find this freedom from views in the first sutta in the Digha Nikaya, in the Brahmajala Sutta, the Great Brahma Net, which describes 62 different views of the self in the cosmos that people were arguing about at the time. The Buddha, when asked about this himself, said, "Well, every one of these views I know, I've been there, and I realize that this view arises dependent upon contact." In other words, something happens, you try to figure it out, and you come up with one of these views, and you hold on to it. The Buddha says, "I know all that, and I know how to release the mind from holding on to that. Because of this, I'm not snared in any of these views or opinions." So it's interesting, isn't it? It sounds so counterintuitive, but he's actually seen all the positions that you could take, and he's saying, "All that action, all that effort, where does it take you? Another place, another position, arguing with other people. Why don't you just come out of needing to have a position? You realize everything and anything that is held onto can't be an ultimate truth. It's just a naming based upon a position. So because of that, this is the end of taking up of rods and bladed weapons or arguments, quarrels, disputes, accusations, divisive tale-bearing, and false speech. This is where these unskillful things cease without remainder, and that is what I teach." So what is it that Buddhas do know? Everything that arises is dependently arisen, is impermanent and not self, and it passes. And so what? What does that mean? Well, there's no perception for that, because through insight into perception, the mind has given up on naming and has realized peace. If you do the practice that takes you to that, you'll know it for yourself.
What is a good question to kind of pose to yourself to like investigate that perception, since it can be kind of a hard thing to see?
Well, I think one of just that question, you say, okay, what is perception? In that sense, then one is kind of shining a light on what you say, and you don't have to have an answer. But it's more like holding it with a... Because as soon as you bring up the word perception in the mind, then it inclines the mind in a particular way and brings up a memory of what perception is. And so then it frames the experience so that there's an investigation there, right? a query, a question. And again, it's not, you don't need to have a definitive answer. It's more like being able to hold that in in awareness and see what the mind tries to do, what stand it tries to take, what position it tries to support. And then that illuminates the habits of the mind.
I like Ajahn Jess' suggestion of using the question, to what extent is the opposite true? So, like, whenever something happened, you say the question and say, well, could, you know, I think it's like this, but
right.
Could it be?
Yeah, could it be just as the same? Yeah, you know, like, I said, oh, this is really good. I say, well,
could it be?
Yeah.
I would also say, I mean, for me, and this is, he's really, he's talking perception in a very, very broad way, whereas the Buddha, you know, uses some other terminology and description, name and form, what makes up name and form, and I utilize those, I think, would be more effective for me to kind of tear apart what's going on in the mind. This is, I think, probably a very, very broad description of perception.
Broad, but it's also what again, how do we define things, or how do we? Because that's the definition in time is, I always found helpful. Because what it does, what gives importance and meaning as a, you know, that which gives importance and meaning to an experience, so that color, shape, memory. I mean, the root of the word perception is in memory. So that what memories are we drawing on? What memories are we inclining towards? What gives it, makes it stand out as an experience? So then being able to recognize that and see what patterns are we either being drawn toward, or what patterns are we repeating?
Yeah. Are you saying that which gives importance and meaning to is perception and time? That's how it's defined, is it?
Yeah. So that's how the literal translation of Sanya in the Thai language is the activity of giving perception and meaning to experience.
So when you do that, to me, it's so rich, it's so much more is given when you do a Thai translation than our single word.
Yes, yeah, it's also, it also has a... The Thai language has a perceptual basis in Buddhism. So.
Yeah.
So it's,
and that's kind of what I mean. Like, you know, he's using perception, where I was more likely to use name and form. And name and form gives you a set of words. You know, it's got the feeling in it. It's got perception in it, which is then, I can utilize to say, what is it about that object, you know, which I can use sanya almost in its form of what is the sign, like,
right.
What makes this particular thing pleasant, you know, what's the particular characteristics, qualities, and then chaitana, what's the intent, what is the evocative nature, like, what is this, yeah. What is this providing for me as a usefulness, or is it to prop up an ego, is it to prop up, you know,
yeah.
You know, thought, you know, different things. So that's why I find this definition of perception be broader than I would normally make it much more perception be more narrow. Oh. And name and form, and, you know, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of, you know, finding working definitions that one finds supportive And also remembering that say within those five khandhas, say the nama dhammas are like in name and form, there's a bit broader context. But then, whatever the case, say within those five khandhas, they are conjoined, they're not disjoined, so that it isn't as if there is a discrete thing that is sanya that you can separate out and it doesn't have anything to do with anything else. So it's just recognizing how that you're describing an action of the mind that is has an inclination in a particular way, but it's also built up with the others around it. So that and name and form in particular is, and of course that's another structure of Enuenama. The name is because you add contact and attention within that as well, and those are really helpful for fleshing out our experience.
So to maybe, I think it is important to like have categories and descriptions of these things, but one of the, like what you were saying in the beginning with like paying attention to how it happens. Like I've found some of the most effective ways for me to identify what sanya is doing in my experience is when it changes quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Because when something happens in my experience and I have a certain, there's an affective association or memories associated, and then it doesn't happen very often, but then sometimes something else can change that shifts your association very quickly.
Yeah.
And to watch, what sort of clusters of concepts and ideas and feelings and memories were around each of those two perceptions.
Yeah. And we do that with people all the time. Sort of like we see somebody and there's something about them. That idiot. You don't even know who they are. And it's just something that just sort of ticks you off, already, and you've already formed a perception. And then they turn to you and smile and say something nice, and and then the perception changes. It's just really quick.
I'm working with that, with the perception of impermanence in meditation. It's really something that I would like to investigate more, but I find most of the time I find it pretty hard to stay there. Occasionally, I'll be able to stabilize there. It's very interesting just to watch thing after thing just fading away. Like sitting in the car going backwards in the whole world and just everything just going away from you. But that doesn't happen so often. Do you have any just how to stabilize or?
Well, the goal is not to. I mean, the purpose of the perception of impermanence. The goal is not to stabilize the perception of impermanence. The goal is to stabilize the perception of stability. in the sense of non-arising or non-cessation or just that sense of relinquishing, because as we contemplate impermanence, then it helps the mind incline to relinquishment and to be able to allow the quality of relinquishment and peace to establish itself. That sense, this is peaceful. This is sublime. This is the stilling of all formations. So, it takes us to that place. So it's a catalyst. So you're not trying to hold it in that sense of holding a perception of impermanence as a as an ultimate goal, but it's more like lifting it up so it helps to act as a catalyst for relinquishment and liberation.
That's a good, interesting perception. This is like your analogy of looking backwards at a car, seeing everything disappear. But actually, if you pay attention, everything is appearing at the same time.
That's the Kuchana Gopa Sutta. When you pay attention to arising, then you can't form the perception of ceasing. If you pay attention, you can't form that idea or that opinion. If you pay attention to ceasing, you can't get caught in arising. So it's like a... it's arising when you see everything it's suffering, dukkha arising, dukkha ceases.
Well, at risk of being pedantic, I just the thought came to mind of like, sunya and panya both come from kind of to knowing, and there's a way of thinking, like, well, what's the bridge between the two? Like, how do you get from perception to discernment?
Mm-hmm.
And because they both have that knowing aspect and then just different prefixes. And it's really, that's where you get sankhara or sankhapa, the constructing, where we actually do the action. And that's where action happens.
Right.
So it's somewhere between perception and discernment. Yeah, about participation.
Right, which is actually like sanya is a something that actually happens to you. In the sense it's kind of automatic. The mind makes those associations. But banya actually relies on the sankhara. So that the banya is in Abhidhamma, then banya is a sankhara, it's a mental formation. So there's the element of jetana, of volition, being able to apply, same with mindfulness, applying of one's volition and directed thought, so that something that one engages in order for it to arise.
Also throwing the manasikara being
that happens
too.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about this the other day, how vijnana, panya, sanya, and panjanati and all these all share the same root. And so like vijnana is the separating, and that happens of course immediately, very, very quick. But then sanya is to know together, that in prefix san. So, and that's manasikara. It's like it's sort of like algebra. We split it into pieces, into nimittas, into things, but then we reassemble it back into an object, into sanya. But it's just, we're always sort of breaking it down and rebuilding it. And the rebuilding is the manasikara. The skillful manasikara, or manasikaroti, is panya.
Yeah.
I suppose I had always thought of panya more as the proper sanya, as like a type of sanya. So I was just wondering. That's a sankhya, thinking of it as a sankhara versus
sankhya. Oh, it is a sankhara. Yeah, absolutely. Because sanya is more of a root function of the mind, and panya is a construct that is skillfully applied, attention and discernment.
And what did Nidya be classified as? Like, where would proper, like, Would that be classified separately from panya?
I don't know. I mean, that would be, certainly aligned with Banya. Because when you think of one of the epithets of the Buddha, Vijana Dharma Sampanna, so that perfect in knowledge and conduct. So that those are, you know, whether it's the mental application of the mind and the physical and verbal aspect, jhana. So then those two are brought to performance or in completion in the Buddha.
If Panya is a sankhara, would you say that greed, hatred, and delusion also would fit in the sankhara categories?
Yeah. Sankhara is huge. What is the Abhidhamma? Is this 52 Chitta Suttas or something? And broken down all into the wholesome and unwholesome. So that's the most extensive. In terms of the khandhas, the sankhara khandhas. So, metta, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic love, sankharas, wisdom, greed, anger.
So would, sannya, as we're talking about it, would there be proper sannya? Anicca sannya or...
I wouldn't classify that, because what we're talking about more is sannya as a part of the five khandhas, whereas the sannya as a, maybe more of as a colloquial expression of how one bringing it up as a perception, as a memory, using it as a label for that one is actually directing attention towards. So anicca sannya, asubha sannya, the Giriman of the sutta, virata sannya.
I also am thinking about how sannya in as a khandha is the habituation of the associations, because they happen somewhat automatically.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking that you could take, one of these, anicca sannyas or practices and practice them so that they become habituated, but that may not necessarily lead to, viraga and vijja and all these things. So you can habituate skillful perceptions, but that still may not lead to the discernment and release.
Yes, there has to be a sort of a cooking, a process that is the lead one of them.